From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 382 of Sunday House Call for January 29th, 2012. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and we are broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And our show will be going until 6 p.m. tonight because of the hockey game that just completed. So looking forward to your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And while we wait for the lines to fill, hopefully so, I'd like to cover an issue that actually is very common. A lot of people, a lot of women per se, come into the office complaining of foot pain, knee pain, shin splints, back pain, and invariably, they come into the office wearing high heels. And when I point this out to them, saying how the high heels are contributing to this problem, I would say that the majority will say, oh, I'm just wearing them today, but I normally don't wear them. Well, I'm sorry, but high heels tend to be worn quite a bit. And in this case, I am interested to provide to you this information from the Journal of Applied Physiology. There is now a new study that provides a scientific explanation for why walking in high heels can be so painful. And the bottom line is that it changes the mechanics of how women walk. So what they did is they had a group of women. In this case, it was a small study, but nevertheless, it was interesting how they did this. They had nine young women who wore high heels for 40 hours per week or more for at least two years, compared to 10 young women who rarely wore high heels. And all of the women walked at their own pace along a 26-foot flat walkway while wearing electrodes on their feet and legs to measure muscle activity. And the walkway was also equipped with a plate to gauge ground reaction forces, and cameras recorded their gait. So both groups walked down this walkway 10 times in their bare feet. And then the high heel wearers walked it another 10 times in their favorite high heels. And as the researchers suspected, the women who regularly wore high heels walked differently than those who didn't, even when they were in their bare feet, which sort of goes along the lines of when I suggest to patients who have foot pain who wear high heels. I say, well, what happens when you wear flat shoes? They say, well, the pain doesn't go away. It's still bothering me. Well, what they found is in these results that they showed that the high heel wearers had shorter strides and mostly used their muscles to walk rather than the more efficient combination of muscle and tendon stretching employed by women who wore flats. So they completely changed the mechanics of their walking when they wore these high heels. And so, for example, the study showed that the muscle strain rate in high heel wearers was 6 times greater than women who wore flat shoes. And so the adaptations over the long term, and this is what the researchers have concluded, the researchers say these sorts of adaptations from long-term heel use may compromise muscle efficiency in barefoot and high-heeled walking and increase the risk of injuries. In fact, what tended to happen is that the calf muscles in these women ended up shorter. So that's why when you try and walk with flat shoes, you're stretching a calf muscle that has accommodated the high heels for so long that you're now pulling on them and they're resisting your ability to walk without high heels. Now, whether this is reversible, and I would imagine it would be over time, this is still something I found very interesting because it is a common problem. It is not something that is just for an occasional person. People coming into the office, it is very common for them to be saying, I have foot pain. You get bunions, your foot gets jammed forward into usually a pointy toe in with high heels. And as a result, you are mashing the bones, you are putting stress on the tissues, the ligaments, the tendons, changing the configuration of the muscles. And over time, it unfortunately causes a lot of damage that is completely preventable. And not only do the feet hurt, but because the back and knees and hips accommodate those changes, it certainly is a contributory factor to other aches and pains that occur over time. Now, remember, this is not something that just occurs when you wear high heels once. This is something that is over the long term. And that is what was interesting about this study, is that it was over 2 years, 40 hours a week of wearing high heels, which is for in business, you know, a lot of women will wear high heels for business wear. And so it was trying to mimic and trying to be as realistic as possible with regards to high heel use. But it's not a natural position to walk in. It might be stylish, but really it goes back, I believe, to Louis XIV in France when he was a very short guy. So he wore platform shoes, high heels, in order to appear taller since he was the king. And when he died, given that everybody copies what the king does, everybody wore them, men and women alike. But when he died, it fell out of favor with men, and women continued to wear the high heels. So once again, men have caused women pain in their lifetimes. So what we're going to do is actually, I'm going to take a break now because our lines are filled up, which is I'm very pleased to report, and then come back and answer your questions in full. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and again, we are here until 6 p.m. this evening. We'll be back right after this break.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And we're going to go right to the phone lines, and good afternoon to Helen in Ottawa.
Yes, I'd like to know your opinion on Aclasta, the infusion for osteoporosis
right.
That's given once a year.
Well, Aclasta is a bisphosphonate, what we call a bisphosphonate medication. So it's really no different than some of the oral medications that are out there. The issue becomes more of one of convenience because it's once a year. And the effect is still the same. It helps build up some bone for women who have a diagnosis of osteoporosis. The issue, though, is that if you have side effects with it, you've already had the infusion, so you have to wait some time for those side effects to disappear. It's not as if you can take it out once it's given. It is a bit expensive because it's something that I believe is not covered. And it is, though, an acceptable treatment, right? It's no, as I mentioned, it's no different than other things such as, you know, if we talk about brand names, Fosamax or Actonel, they're all in that same category of medications called the bisphosphonates. Have you been treated for osteoporosis before, or is this the first treatment being offered?
No, I've been. She's been taking Avista.
Okay.
Has developed a lot of fractures.
Okay, so Avista is sort of a secondary medication to use. It's called raloxifene, and it is what we call a selective estrogen receptor modulator. All that simply means is it mimics the effects of estrogen without the same hormonal effect of estrogen. So it tricks the body into thinking that there's some estrogen there, which the theory was, and the hypothesis, the theory is that by using that, you will slow down bone degeneration or bone loss. It does work for some women. It's not the first choice that you would use, but for someone who is already having osteoporosis fractures, yeah, they would have to be more aggressive in terms of how you treat this. So there certainly is you can use Aclasta, you can use Fosamax, you can use Actonel. There's all those are equally efficacious in terms of trying to help reverse that process.
That's fine. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Helen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. And good afternoon to Judy in Kempville.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling about my father.
Yes.
He's 82 years old, mm-hmm. in fairly good health, a little bit of high blood pressure, but that's fairly recently, in the last 6 months to a year. He's only on 4 milligrams of Coversil.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's not what the problem is. About 3 weeks ago or so, he complained of being very tired and weak.
Okay.
He's sleeping, like going to bed at 10 and not getting up till about 11 in the morning, which is very unusual for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like normally a very active person. He usually can't even get dressed in the morning or throughout the day, for that matter. Loss of appetite. Now, he had a very similar episode to this 2 years ago.
Okay.
Around the same time, started just before Christmas, and he wasn't really back on his feet until probably March, and then it took him a good 3 or 4 months to get back to normal. We have had him into the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
He's just recently finished a cardiac assessment, saw a cardiologist, and he said there's nothing physical wrong with my dad.
At least from a cardiology standpoint.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, this is where it gets interesting. He's suggesting that he might have something called mental exhaustion. Now, my dad was working up until about a year ago, mm-hmm. when he finally fully retired, but he has stayed fairly active. I mean, he's out doing yard work. He's out at the store every day. He's still driving. And in the last 3 weeks, as I said, he can't even come out and heat himself a cup of hot water. He's lost a noticeable amount of weight.
Mm-hmm.
He is a normal weight, usually. What else can I tell you? There's no other problems. And I agree with you. The cardiologist has ruled out his heart.
Right.
But I'm wondering where we can go to next.
Okay. Well, now this was a sudden change. Like 3 weeks ago, he went from one day being fine. Then
one
the next day
he was out driving the car or going to the store. The next day, he couldn't make himself a cup of hot water.
Okay, so the things that you always want to rule out, especially in the elderly, when there's a sudden change in either activity, mood, whatever it is, where they see this sudden dramatic shift, is you have to rule out infectious causes. Common causes for the elderly that can exhibit these type of symptoms, and the interesting thing is that the same infections in younger adults don't produce these symptoms. This is why, with regards to geriatric patients, you have to think of these things sort of outside of the box. So common infections that may not necessarily show the same symptoms other than what you're seeing now, urinary tract infections, bladder infections, are very common in the elderly and can certainly cause changes in everything that you've mentioned.
Okay.
So getting a urine test is a very easy and straightforward way to do that. Blood test to look for infections, so something that we call a CBC, which is a complete blood count. We'll look at his white blood cell count to see if that's elevated.
Okay. I believe they did do blood work when we took him into emergency.
Right.
But he is seeing his family doctor on the 10th, and I just wanted to know what we should be checking out and what to ask for.
Yeah, so infectious causes. So
yes.
Urine, blood test. So blood test, his lungs as well. I don't know if he had a chest X-ray.
Yes, he did have a chest X-ray.
Okay, and it was clear.
Yes.
Thyroid function tests also, because thyroid, if it stops working very well, low thyroid hormone can do that. Other things, frankly, that can do this that may be missed, although not necessarily seen in terms of overall activity. Unfortunately, sometimes strokes can occur, and you don't necessarily have to have loss of movement of limbs. You can get behavior changes as a result of that.
And how would we evaluate or check that out?
Usually on the basis of the first, in terms of the clinical exam, is actually talking to the patient, checking memory. So there's mini mental status exams that can be done, things that you can actually assess cognitive function first to see if there's been a deterioration compared to before. That certainly can be done in the office. That can be followed up, if there's something to suggest that, with either CT of the head to look and see if there's been any damage. But that CT is left afterwards. It's not the first thing that you would do.
Okay. Now, when this happened a couple of years ago, he did. They did refer him for a geriatric assessment,
mm-hmm.
and everything checked out good. He's a little bit forgetful in recent, but he's a chemist, and he can tell you anything about chemistry.
Right. I mean, and his mood is still okay.
He's getting a little bit down because he doesn't know what's wrong with him. He's never been sick.
I mean,
he's a very healthy guy, and being flat on his back and not even be able to have a shower on a daily basis is getting to him.
Now, is he having any pain anywhere?
When this first started, he was complaining of chest pain, mm-hmm. but that was only the first day or so, and that's why we asked to see a cardiologist.
Okay. So, again, the main focus for him, and waiting till the 10th, I think, is a little bit too long to wait if he's already losing weight.
Right.
And he's not able to, you know, the problem is that if he's going to not be able to move around very much, part of the risk is developing pneumonias. If he's not moving around, he's not able to breathe as well. He's not clearing out his lungs as well. So there's a risk of pneumonia, just as anybody who may be lying in bed for too long.
Right.
That can happen.
And he is cold. He's complaining about being cold all
the time. So, you know, I would, and if there's some infectious process going on, you know, he really needs to be looked at this week because infections, by the nature of what infections are, they continue to grow and get worse. So the last thing you want is for any sepsis, which is where the infection originally, if it's in the bladder, spreads and goes into the bloodstream. That produces much more complicated disease. So you at least want to rule out infectious processes, metabolic processes, again, so thyroid function would be one. Checking vitamin B12 levels, sometimes low
B12. He is on B12.
Yeah, so sometimes low levels can do that. But again, if there's been this sudden change, you know, whenever there is a sudden change in somebody who is otherwise well, you have to look at things that can cause sudden changes. So yes, heart can certainly do that, but he had an assessment done. It's not his heart.
Right.
So
right.
You have to look at other systems. So you have to look at infectious processes, bladder, lung. Sometimes even a chest X-ray of the lung may miss an early pneumonia. So that's another thing that has to be considered. So you have to listen to the lungs again. Checking his blood pressure, making sure that that's still okay, making sure it's not too low. So there's also, you know, checking, again, if he has weight loss or unexplained weight loss, you have to think of other things that can do that. So sometimes growths can do that as well. You wouldn't see that happen from one day to the next.
Well, he's not eating. That's why he's losing the weight.
Yeah. So obviously something is up, and there are things that can be done to rule in and out these processes that I discussed. So
okay. But you wouldn't just ignore him and tell him to start walking more? And
No.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
From what you're describing, he's a gentleman that is normally very active.
Yes.
And there's right now a change in his lifestyle that has resulted in him not doing anything, and he's getting frustrated from what you're describing.
Yes.
Because he wants to get up and go. So it's not depression, because depression, he wouldn't want to do anything to begin with.
And it would have been more gradual.
And it would have been usually more gradual or some trigger to lead to a depressive illness. So I wouldn't hang depression on this at all, because although he has symptoms suggestive of it, it was a sudden change without any specific trigger, and he wants to get better. It's not as if he's not trying to get better and move around.
Okay.
So it just sounds, my first, in terms of a differential diagnosis, the first thing I'd want to rule out is infection. That would be the first thing to do.
Okay, I wrote them all down as you were listing them off, so we'll see the doctor this week.
All right, Judy.
Instead of the 10th, and I'll let you know what happens.
I would very be interested to know.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the number to call. And we're going to go to line 3 and Rose. Good afternoon. Rose, are you there?
Hi, good afternoon, doctor.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
It's regarding rheumatoid arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And it was under control until last November. I take methotrexate,
mm-hmm.
the 0.5, 5 at once a week.
Okay.
And it was under control till then, until I went to see the doctor at the end of the month. Then she said, since everything is okay, I could take 4 instead of 5.
Mm-hmm.
Then I took two consecutive weeks. Then my hand starts swelling,
mm-hmm.
and the pain, it comes on my shoulder, my feet, everywhere. Then she said at the time, in case something happened after 4, I should increase to 5. Then I increased to 5, But still, the hands are swelling.
Mm-hmm.
Even my feet underneath is really bad. Sometimes I had a hard time to walk on my knee. And the worst part is on my hands, every morning is swelling.
Okay.
And starting December, I took naproxen, 500 mg, twice a day. But with all that, the 5 months a week, with 500 twice a day, my hands are swelling every morning, and I'm having some pain.
Okay, so Rose, what we'll do is we're going to take a break right now for the news.
Okay.
And then I'm going to put you on hold, and when we come back, we're going to go over this in a little bit more detail to see what we can do to reverse this process for you.
Thank you.
Okay, so hang on just a few minutes.
Thank you.
And what we'll do is we are going to take a break for the news. You're listening to Sunday House Call. We've got Rose, who wants to talk about, again, rheumatoid arthritis worsening, and Nanette in Ottawa, the value of aspartame. We'll be back right after the news.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. Checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And we're going to go back to the phone lines, and here's hoping there's a softer song later on in the show. Line three, and we're going to go back and speak with Rose. Just to review what you had mentioned, you were initially taking methotrexate, 12.5 milligrams or 5 2.5 milligram tablet once a week, and that was controlling your rheumatoid arthritis. And then you were instructed to reduce it to 4 tablets a week, and that's when you noticed that the symptoms are coming back. The hands were swelling, the joints were starting to hurt more, and you've now resumed the 5, but it has not reversed the process. Is my understanding correct about that?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And that you've also used anti-inflammatories such as naproxen, 500 twice a day, and that has not helped either?
No.
Okay. Well, what tends to happen with rheumatoid arthritis is that when there is a relapse, in this case, the relapse seems to have been from reducing the medication, it can take sometimes a greater dose of the medication than you originally were taking in order to calm it down. So my question to you would be, when are you scheduled to see your rheumatologist again?
On Monday.
Okay. So the question you have to ask them now is, with this dose now being back at 5 tablets a week, what their plan is to try and get the rheumatoid arthritis relapse under control. Are they planning to increase the dose? Are they planning to add a different medication to try to reverse the process and get you under control? It's likely that you will be able to get under control again, given that you were doing so well before the reduction in the medication.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unfortunately you're having morbidity, which is suffering from this particular change in the course of the disease, but you should be able to regain control again relatively quickly, but you have to ask the rheumatologist how aggressive they're going to be to get this under control quickly. So you have to know what their plan is, not just for tomorrow, but what the plan is over the next, you know, over the next literally 2 or 3 months, what they plan to do. If you don't respond, what's the next step? And if that doesn't work, what's the next step after that? So you need to know for yourself so that you know what the plan is, as opposed to not knowing what happens next.
Okay.
So again, the question you'll be asked, questions I would suggest you ask the rheumatologist tomorrow,
okay,
are, is the methotrexate going to be increased?
Okay.
Are they going to use other medications to control the relapse of the disease?
Okay.
And what is their time frame that they are looking at with regards to resolving it? That is, how quickly do they think the treatment will help reverse the process? Or at least, what is their time frame And within that time frame, what is their plan with regards to changing treatment over that time if you're not responding?
Okay. Okay. What's the time frame?
Right.
To reverse it? Is there any other medication I should take?
That's right. And the plan. It's very important to know what the plan is.
What is the plan?
Not only for this week, but over the next few months.
Okay. Hold on. Okay. I'm sorry. With a client here.
That's fine.
Yeah. Okay. Is there any other medication? Okay. I have to go.
You have to go? All right, Rose.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All the best.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-23 is our long-distance number. And we're going to say good afternoon to Nanette in Ottawa. Nanette, hi.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
How are you?
Fine, thanks. And I just want to say how lucky we are to have you here.
Well, thank you.
How lucky we are. It's with regards to in the Smart Shopper today that I got today.
Yes.
It's headed up, get rid of aspartame. And I'll just read a little part
here.
Aspartame penetrates the blood barrier, hence entering the brain and creating neurotoxic havoc in the brain center.
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget, aspartame is a drug and is not natural in any way. And just another little part,
right.
Unnatural artificial sweeteners may indeed affect your health. Why take the chance? Now, I use Splenda.
Yes.
And say about a tablespoon a day.
Mm-hmm.
In what I use it for. Now,
right.
When I read this, I wonder about Splenda.
Well, what this unfortunately, Nanette, is what we call a propagation of chemophobia, is using emotionally charged words like toxins, neurotoxin, unnatural. The point, if we take this point by point, the first thing is aspartame, when it is used in soft drinks, has been extensively reviewed. In fact, the European Food Safety Agency, and I had an interview with the chief of that agency years ago when they reviewed all the evidence with regards to aspartame, found that there was no evidence that it caused health difficulties. In fact, they found that the theoretical toxic dose, the dose that could potentially affect you, would have to be you consuming 50 cans of soda per day, every day. So when we discuss toxicology, it's very important to keep in mind the dose and the duration of the compound being discussed. Because when we're dealing with a dose that is extremely small, you end up with extremely small changes. In fact, aspartame is really two amino acids or two proteins, right? Aspartic acid and phenylalanine are two of the compounds that are joined together that trick the tongue into thinking that it's tasting sugar or sweet things, but really it's just two proteins, and those proteins are broken down in the stomach, and they are converted into other proteins that the body, the amino acids are used in construction of other proteins that your body may use. And yes, when it is broken down, you do get metabolites such as formaldehyde and other things, except the formaldehyde lasts literally a millionth of a second in your liver as it's gone through the breakdown process. Just as when you eat an apple that contains acetone and cyanide and other chemical compounds that in great doses would be harmful to you, in tiny doses that are found in apples, your liver will break them down without any consequence because they're not hanging around long enough to cause you any harm. So with regards to the claim, and I'm glad you called about this, Nanette, for them to claim that it causes neurotoxicity, I would really like to see their data that supports that, what neurotoxin is being produced, where it actually is affecting the brain, and where have they reproduced these results? Because anything less than that is simply fear-mongering, and it causes a lot of confusion and a lot of fear in general population when there's reports like this. Especially, that goes to your second point with regards to Splenda or sucralose. It's a completely different molecule, and sucralose, frankly, I use Splenda a lot because because sugar in itself, to me, is worse for you with all the extra sugar in your diet than using that. And sucralose is simply an extra side chain added onto a normal sugar molecule, a sucrose, that then doesn't get absorbed into your bloodstream. It sort of stays in your intestines. So that's why you get much less calories associated with that. So there's certainly no harm with using sucralose. That's what's found in now a lot of the zero products, right? All the soda zero products that are out there tend to have sucralose in them. So aspartame, sucralose, no evidence that causes harm. In fact, what's more harmful are the foods that people eat that are high in calories or great in calories that have lots of sugar in them to begin with. So if I was to say which ones to use, if you can avoid non-nutritional food that contains lots of sugar, sodas being one of them, and you're using sucralose instead, go right ahead.
Okay, then, Dr. Dworkin. Well, thanks kindly. It's just I've heard sugar being called white death, and, I've been using Splenda
right.
for quite a while.
It's like anything else. Things in moderation are unlikely to harm you, but the problem with our society is that we have people, for example, that drink 12 cans of soda a day that are sugar-laden,
right.
and that's where the problem is. An occasional can of soda, who cares? But, if someone is trying to reduce their calorie intake, nothing wrong with using a diet product.
Thanks kindly, Dr. Dworkin.
You're very welcome.
All the best to you.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And we'll take a small break. Lots of lines available. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back with your calls right after the break.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Some come out in sympathy, some come out in support.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. Lots of lines available. We are here till 6 p.m., looking forward to your calls. There have been a lot of excellent calls so far this afternoon. And we're going to go to line one and speak to Olive in Winchester.
Hello.
Hi, Olive.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin. I'm calling you about atrial fibrillation.
Yes.
I am experiencing that these days. In February of 2009, I had my aortic valve replaced.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some complications and was in hospital for 7 weeks, but I got over that. However, by the autumn, November of 2010, I was experiencing this AFib and was in the general hospital for a week. They gave me, metoprolol.
Yes.
Some people seem to call it metoprolol, but
right.
anyway, they gave that to me. They also put me on Coumadin.
Yes.
The Coumadin did not seem to level out. I kept going for these INR readings, but it didn't level out. So then in November of 2010, I went on Pradax.
Okay.
And I'm on that still today.
Okay.
I felt tired over the summer of 2011 and the autumn of also 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And with that tiredness, my blood pressure crept up and so did my pulse reading.
Mm-hmm.
133/94. And it was not unusual to have a pulse reading of 121, 124.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I was out of breath, legs aching, swelling in my ankles and feet, head aching. Right now I'm on Pradax, 150 milligrams twice daily, metoprolol, 75 milligrams twice daily,
right.
and digoxin, I'm taking 1/2 pill
right.
of a 0.25 milligram.
Okay.
But I am still experiencing my heart flip-flopping, and I generally do not feel well. I just wondered what you felt I should do.
So now when your heart, when you mentioned that your heart is flip-flopping, are you finding that it's going from a normal rhythm back to an irregular rhythm?
That's right, yes. Okay. And I can feel that.
Okay.
I feel it in my ears when I'm lying down, and, well, I feel it in my body, my chest in particular.
Okay. And then when that happens, does that, you also get other symptoms? Does the fatigue get worse when that happens?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what I would suggest is if you're having symptoms associated with a change in heart rhythm, the cardiologists that you are seeing have to then provide you with a different means of controlling the rate.
Yes.
Right. Because if you have documented changes in your heart rate that is going from what we call a normal sinus rhythm where the heart is beating regularly, you know, it's going 70 or 80 or 90, and it's a regular beat without anything in between, and then it all of a sudden changes to one where your heart rate is up at 110, 120, and it's not regular, it's sort of flopping all over the place.
That's right.
That means your heart is going from, is converting from sinus rhythm to atrial fibrillation, and then likely it goes back again.
Yeah.
And that's not the greatest thing to have happen all the time.
No, it isn't. No, it's very tiring, and every task looks so big.
And also you're getting swelling in your feet.
Yes, I do have slight swelling, not a lot, but slight. I am on a diuretic called furosemide.
Right. That can help. It also can help blood pressure a little bit. But ultimately, there's a few things. I mean, one is your blood pressure tends to go up a little bit more than it should.
Yes.
So they mention that to them as well, that when you measure it, it's a little bit high. I mean, 133 over 94 is a little bit, the 94 is too high. I mean, ideally, you'd like to see that more around 80 as opposed to it being 94.
Yes. We invested in a blood pressure cuff, and I take it morning and night. And one night, I believe it was Friday night of last week, the lower number, the systolic number, was 101. I had never seen a three-digit number in that spot before.
So you mean the lower number, the diastolic.
Oh, it's diastolic.
Yeah, systolic is the one on top. Diastolic is the one on the bottom.
All right. Well,
yeah, so then that's elevated. So it just sounds like, from what you're describing, that the blood pressure control is not optimized, and also the heart rhythm control is not as good as it can be. And they do have a lot of options to offer you with regards to controlling the heart rate.
Yes.
But ideally, you would want to correct that first.
Yes.
Before trying to determine other, you can do other things to look to check for fatigue.
Yes.
But there is a condition for which you can experience those symptoms. Plus, metoprolol in and of itself can also make you feel tired. So that is one of the side effects of metoprolol.
Yes.
Now, that being said, you can't just stop the metoprolol because that can make the AFib worse.
Yes.
So this is why the cardiologist, after you explain to them exactly what you mentioned to me, has to provide you with other alternatives. It may mean a pacemaker, for example.
Yes.
It may mean a different change in medication.
Yes.
So there are things that are available that can help improve your quality of life.
Yes.
And the reason they start with the medications first and these type of medications is they're trying to minimize the discomfort, right?
Yes.
You go from the least interventionist, so you don't want to do things, go inside a body. You don't want to start putting pacemakers in. You don't want to do invasive procedures that have a greater risk first.
Yes.
You'd rather use the medical therapy first to try and alleviate the symptoms, see how someone does. And if they're not doing well or they're not responding as well, then you move to the next stage of treatment. So that's where you are right now with regards to the cardiologist, is asking them, okay, what's the next stage to this treatment? Because my heart rate is changing. Yeah. They may want to do a Holter monitor. They may want to actually check and see if the heart flip-flops, if this is occurring every day, just to see it printed out for them so they can actually see what rate is going on. And then after evaluating that, deciding on a different course of treatment if it certainly indicates that that has to be.
Yes. This has been going on now for 2 months.
Yeah.
And I am getting pretty well fed up.
Now, when are you supposed to see them again?
I see my cardiologist in April.
Well, what I would suggest is actually to either through your family physician,
yes,
to say, can you contact the cardiologist to say that my heart rate is changing and flip-flopping,
yes,
a lot, and really waiting till April is not acceptable.
Yes.
Or even calling the cardiologist office directly.
Okay.
And just to say, look, I'd like to see them,
yes,
earlier. I'm having some difficulties. My heart rate is changing. I'm feeling strange when my heart rate changes.
Mm-hmm.
Can they come? Can I come in and can they assess me earlier?
Yes. Okay. All right. I can try that.
All right, Olive.
There is also a cardiologist who comes from the Heart Institute,
right,
to the Winchester Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I had thought maybe of seeing him.
The only thing I would say is that it would be important for that cardiologist to have all your medical information.
Yep, because I realize.
Because if they don't, then they're, yep, at a disadvantage.
I understand.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you very much.
You're very,
Doctor,
welcome, Olive.
Okay. Bye-bye now. For now.
And we are going to take a small break for the news. All our lines are free, so I don't want to talk for the next half hour to myself. I do have some interesting news items that I could bring up. Actually, some quite exciting ones that I found quite interesting today. But I would rather be speaking with you. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. And we will be back with, hopefully, your calls after the news break.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
*520 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. Are the numbers to call, and all the lines are available. It is a desert out there right now. I don't know if you're watching the hockey game, NHL All-Stars, but there we go. People are calling in. Okay, so while they're calling in, I wanted to review a story out of Davos. Although, you know, you may have heard the financial stuff with Stephen Harper giving his talk in Davos. Well, there's also a genetics and science component to it as well. And there is a device that has been developed, and that cracks the code of life within hours, and they're saying could potentially revolutionize healthcare. So what this does is it reads your DNA sequence completely within 2 hours. Now, this was unheard of years ago. This was actually something that was extremely expensive to do, with machines costing millions of dollars, taking many, many days and weeks to be able to determine genetic sequences. And what's the what's the use out of this? Well, what they'll be able to do is allow, with regards to cancer treatment, allow doctors to know immediately what kind of disease they have, the genetics behind it, allowing them to target specific therapies precisely, and to avoid harmful delays or mistakes being made in treatment. It will be able to identify, for example, superbug outbreaks, identifying the bug strain, and begin planning treatment within hours rather than days or weeks. And this was actually done, if you remember the E. coli outbreak or the bacteria outbreak in Europe, where they used a machine that used the same principles, but it was a much larger machine that actually was able to identify these bacteria. And now they've made a more portable device that can be taken out in the field and be able to identify these various bugs that are out there. The man behind the revolution is, in this case, is Jonathan Rothberg. He's a biotechnician and CEO of a company called Ion Torrent, owned by U.S. firm Life Technologies, which produces this particular device called the Ion Proton, the first desktop semiconductor-based gene sequencer. And it appears to be, it'll be a machine that will cost less than, it actually can do a genome evaluation in people for less than $1,000. Now, remember, this cost lots of money before to be able to do something like that. And previous machines would cost more than $500,000, and it would take weeks to get information on your genome. So it's designed for discovery. That is to find new genes that are involved in cancer, find new genes that are involved, for example, in autism, and new genes for diabetes. So we'll see what happens. You know, there's always claims that are made, but they're trying to reduce the size of this to actually become the size of a handheld device, almost like what they call the Star Trek tricorder. So very interesting because it'll monitor genetic sequences, help identify organisms and diseases quicker, and hopefully improve healthcare for everybody. Well, now all our lines are available, and so we are going to go to the phone lines and speak to Norma in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if I could ask you a question about thyroid.
Yes.
I had a thyroid operation in 1991, mm-hmm. and I had all my thyroid removed except for a partial left lobe.
Okay.
And last spring, they found a complex growth mm-hmm. on the left lobe, and they did a biopsy, which proved to be okay.
Okay.
But since then, I've been having a lot of swelling of my throat. And I've been back and had an ultrasound done of my throat again, mm-hmm. and they tell me that the growth has not grown any larger than it originally was.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if I will have to live with this swelling, if this is natural, or if there is something that can be done mm-hmm. about it.
Now, with regards to the swelling, is this noticeable swelling on the outside, or is this a feeling on the inside when you're trying to swallow?
It's a noticeable swelling on the outside mm-hmm. With a pressure on my esophagus, mm-hmm. a feeling of pressure on my esophagus on the inside.
Okay. These kind of things can be difficult to treat, Norma, especially if there's no change in the size of that lobe itself, which is a good thing. I'm glad to hear that. But if there's no interference, that is, you can swallow without anything getting blocked, if you can eat solids without anything getting blocked, the question then becomes, what do we do to that area that actually improves things? The sensation that you have is one of the swelling, but it's the functional component that has to be looked at also. Because if part of the problem is that if you start to cut away or try to probe the area, you may actually make things worse in that area as opposed to better. So I guess my question for you would be, when you're eating and drinking, is that interfered with or things go down okay?
Usually, I have choked, strangely enough, on liquids, mm-hmm. not on solids, but liquids. But I'm careful.
Okay. Now, are there other medical conditions you might have? For example, like gastric reflux or anything along those lines?
Yes, I do have that.
Okay, because that can also cause problems with swallowing and also give you that sensation in your throat. Again, swelling, the way to measure that swelling when it does happen is actually to take a tape measure to go around the circumference of the neck to see if there's any measurable change. Because if it and the interesting thing is that things can feel swollen, and they really do feel swollen, but when you take the measurement, nothing much is noticed on the outside, which means it's likely things that are going on within the esophagus or the airway itself that cause that sensation, and the brain ends up thinking that there's swelling when it's because it's giving you that same type of feeling. So ideally, what would be helpful is to measure around the neck when it does happen, when it's not happening, and then when it is happening, to see if there's any difference. And if there's appreciable swelling, usually you'll see a difference of 2 or 3 centimeters, about an inch more, if something is going to be swollen. So that will also help you have sort of concrete evidence that if there's swelling, you can say, look, this is what my neck circumference is like when things are okay. This is what my neck circumference is like when I'm not okay. And if there is a big difference, it gives them at least something concrete to look at. If, on the other hand, you're having those symptoms and there isn't much of a change, then you have to actually look at what's going on inside. So it could be the reflux that's doing that. It could be something with the airway itself that's doing that. So those are sort of the two approaches that should be taken in order to evaluate this condition for you.
I see. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dworkin.
You're very welcome, Norma.
Thank you. I appreciate your advice.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And over to line two and Mike in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Quick question.
Yes.
I'm from a high-risk group. I usually get the flu shot every year.
Mm-hmm.
This year, I wasn't able to take it for reasons because I was sick and I couldn't take the flu shot.
Okay.
And then I was away out of the country for a month.
Sure.
Is it too late to take the flu shot right now?
It's coming towards the end of the season. There are patients in our practice who have had their flu shots this week because they haven't been able to get them up to now. There's no harm in doing it.
Okay.
Whether it's going to protect, it takes a couple of weeks to develop an antibody response, so that takes us now to mid-February.
Okay.
Flu season usually runs till the end of February, maybe the beginning of March. So in terms of risk-benefit, low risk, but also probably not a huge benefit now.
Okay.
As much as I am a very, very big proponent of vaccines, would I do it? If it hasn't caused you any problems, you know, you could certainly do it to have some antibodies built up,
mm-hmm.
but it is towards the end of the season.
Yeah. Okay, so probably just wait till next year, I guess.
Well, again, it's when you look at it, flu clinics have pretty much shut down, I think, from public health as well.
Okay.
So it's towards the end of the season. So, you know, if they're doing that, it certainly would be an indication that the bulk of the flu that you would normally would have seen has already passed. So your risk is relatively low.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Mike.
Okay.
Bye-bye now. What we're probably going to do is take a small break since we're coming up to 15 minutes to. And when we come back, we have Lois and Nepean would like to talk about energy drinks, Joan and Aylmer, but sleeping problems. Dave, who is from Ottawa, problems with feet and legs. Dave has gone. And we have Lucy in Armpire. So we'll get to your calls. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. I'm about to lose my mind. 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And right back to the phone lines. Good afternoon to Lois in Nepean.
Good afternoon, Hi. Dr. Dworkin.
How are you, Lois?
I'm fine, thanks.
That's good.
I'd like your expert opinion on the power drinks like Red Bull. How bad are they for young people? They seem to...
Well, there is some concern with regards to, as with anything, it's the dose that people are taking. So if someone has a small glass of an energy drink, I would probably say no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But when people are drinking sometimes 2-3 cans of those 500 milliliter cans in a day, which some people do, that's a lot of caffeine to consume.
Mm-hmm.
And the caffeine itself can cause agitation and increased anxiety and increased heart rate. And caffeine is something that people get hooked on, not in a horrible way, but, you know, look at people who are used to their coffees in the morning and they're pretty snarky until they actually get their caffeine fixed. So there is that component. I think part of the issue is when the energy drinks are used in combination with alcohol intake.
Okay.
Which tends to be which we tend to see in sort of later adolescence, people,
yeah.
Young adults, 18 to 25 years of age, where the alcohol tends to be a depressant. So they use an energy drink to give them a bit of a boost. And part of the problem is then the self-awareness about what they're able to do and not do is lost. So you have increased risk of, you know, someone may think that they can drive because they feel energetic, they feel their senses heightened, but
mm-hmm.
the alcohol is still having an effect on their reaction time. So there's that component to it. You know, you're not going to be able to get rid of energy drinks. It's not, I don't believe in banning things. You know, it's what adults
mm-hmm.
do is their business. It's more children, adolescents, what they're consuming.
Yeah. Yes.
And how it's marketed. So mm-hmm. I would say, yeah, if you have somebody who's 10 years old and they're drinking energy drinks, I would be pretty concerned about that because it's a lot of caffeine for a 10-year-old to be taking in. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you have a 16 or 17-year-old who has the body weight of an adult to begin mm-hmm. with, mm-hmm. it becomes less of an issue. Still, I'm not a fan of that. I certainly wouldn't recommend it. But, you know, all you can do is provide information to people and they make their own decisions.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's not a product I generally use. In fact, I have no desire to have them. It's not anything that really turns me on at all.
No.
So, but for others, they want to do it. I think, again, to be consistent with what I've mentioned before with regards to compounds that we are exposed to, it's in this case, it's moderation. If someone is not overusing it and it's used appropriately, you know, mm-hmm. that's their business.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Lois.
Bye-bye
now. We're going to go to, let's see, we have very quickly, Lucy in Arm Prior. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, doctor. I have benign essential tremors.
Yes.
And I'm on propranolol.
Yes.
And I heard the Mayo Clinic have a cure for this. And I wonder why this happened to me. I don't understand what it is.
Well, benign essential tremors are, as the name implies, they're not dangerous. They're not due to any specific disease. They're actually a result of how the nerve and muscle works together.
Okay.
Normally, what we have on our nerves are sensors that tell our body how stretched our muscles become. So when your muscle, think of it this way, if we just sort of create a mental image, say just imagine a muscle with a tiny spring that's attached on the top of the muscle, okay? And when the muscle stretches, the spring stretches as well. You can actually see that spring stretch, right?
Right.
And attached to that spring is a wire, and that wire measures how much that spring is stretching. So in our muscles, what we have are very similar systems. We have a little, it's called a muscle spindle. It's a little spring-like molecular object that is hooked up to a nerve that tells the brain and tells the muscle how much it's stretching and prevents the muscle from overstretching. So the muscle, for example, if your muscle starts to stretch too much, the spring tells the muscle, you're stretching too much, we're going to make that muscle contract to prevent it from tearing. And so with benign essential tremors, what happens is this process of telling the muscle you've stretched too much, let's contract down, then it contracts down, then the muscle stretches again, contracts down. It sets up a loop that goes around and around and around. So in effect, what happens is, and that's why it tends to get worse when you try and hold things very tightly to do fine movements, is you get a feedback loop. The nerve is telling the muscle that you've overstretched, the muscle saying, well, I'll contract down, but then you want the muscle to stretch again, and it tells it to contract down, and around it goes, and the net result is this tremor. And so what the propranolol does is it blocks that nerve function. Mm-hmm. It blocks the signal and tones it down so that it doesn't send the signal out as often, so you don't get that muscle contracting and twitching as much, and the tremor tends to disappear. So that's how the treatment is used. I haven't heard of a cure for that. I know that propranolol is the medication of choice and
right.
used according to dose response. So sometimes some people can get away with 10 milligrams a day. Others need to take more than that. But there's a huge, huge dosing range that can be used to be able to control that. Most people tend to be controlled at around 30 or 40 milligrams a day.
Is that not hard on your system? I mean, it's a beta blocker, isn't it? It has to do with your heart.
It is, except that in order for it to have a dramatic effect on your heart and blood pressure, the usual doses for that are closer to the 150 milligram range. So when you're taking low doses, it's not enough to really have that effect. It can slow your heart rate down a little bit, maybe make you feel a bit tired, but you're using very small doses compared to what it was originally designed for mm-hmm. with regards to controlling blood pressure.
But you haven't heard about this one from Mayo Clinic.
I haven't heard if it's if it must be some medication they're using.
No, it's something like a shock treatment or something.
I'd have to look that up to know what it is. But it would have to be something that would be as easy to treat as using the propranolol without causing any damage. So I'm not sure what the shock would do.
Well, it evidently cures it.
Yeah. I'd have to see the end result of that particular study from. You said it's.
You
at
haven't
the, at,
heard about it then.
No, it's. At, you said it's at the Mayo.
Mayo Clinic.
Mayo
yes.
Clinic? I'll look
it
that
evidently
up.
There was a gentleman who played in an orchestra.
Uh huh.
And he couldn't play his violin anymore.
And then
they gave him this whatever it was, and it cured him completely.
Hmm. So yeah. I'm looking at the Mayo Clinic right now,
uh-huh.
And they're talking about essential tremor.
Yeah,
essential tremor treatment at the Mayo Clinic. Just I'm curious because it's good. I'm glad that you called. I mean, this is a nice. This is why I like doing the show, because people find out stuff that I don't know about, and that's actually good.
Everything.
But I'm looking to see what they do. I'd probably have to spend a bit of time to look at it because they're not providing me with the specific treatment that that you're talking about. It's probably deeper into their website.
Okay.
So, but I will look that up to try and find out what it is that they're offering.
Oh, great.
Because that's the other thing too would be cost, right? Because you have to think.
I don't care what it costs. I've had it.
I know.
I just want to pay it and get out.
Now, does the medication work for you?
Not all the time.
It doesn't.
I don't like taking pills. I really don't.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather get to the point of why I can't have a cure for this. And
right.
When I heard about it from Mayo Clinic, I thought, well, jeepers, if there's something there, I'll go.
Well, here they've mentioned what they'll use sometimes is looks like they can use Botox, anti-seizure medications, beta blockers.
Botox?
Botox is one of them that they're offering. Physical therapy. Surgery for severely disabling, deep brain stimulation, a long, thin electrical probe into the part of the brain responsible for tremors, and it transmits. This is maybe what you're talking about. This device transmits painless electrical pulses to interrupt signals from the thalamus of the brain that may be causing the tremors. So,
okay,
that's pretty significant surgery, though.
Oh, it is,
Joan. Yes, that's putting an electrode right into your brain.
Uh-oh.
So. Yeah, so I if the beta blocker is working, you know what? Stay away from the surgery for now.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you, doctor.
All the best,
Very
Lucy.
Very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. My apologies to Joan and Elmer. We've completely run out of time. Thanks to Dave for producing Sunday House Call, and we'll be back again next week, I think at our regular time at 4 p.m. from 4 to 5. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You've been listening to Sunday House Call. Thanks for all your calls and have a great week.
I saw her today at the reception. A glass of